nada sirve escaparse de uno mismo, de nada sirve.
Hello and welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up on the show, we are having a conversation about the move from moderate to low risk in the state of Utah. Also, some new information about the ties between Test Utah and the state of Utah and that relationship. And as also, we're going to have a conversation about coronavirus and immunity. Joining me on the phone for this conversation, we've got Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham. And Matt, good morning and welcome to you.
Good morning, Roger.
We've also got reporter Bethany Rogers. And good morning. Thanks for being here, Bethany.
Thanks for having me.
And editorial page editor and columnist George Pyle. Welcome and thanks to you as well. Good morning.
Hey, Roger, it's been a while.
It has been a while. Thanks for joining, George.
You bet.
Listeners, you can join us as well with your questions and comments. Call 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can also always tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Matt Canham, we are going to start with you. Utah Governor Gary Herbert yesterday announced that much of the state of Utah would transition from orange to yellow level risk level, that is to say from moderate to low risk. Some parts of the state, though, would not be making that move, and we'll get to that in just a second. But for those parts of the state that are, what does going from yellow or what does going from orange to yellow actually mean?
That's a great question, Roger. So there's a lot of things that will change, and some of it feels like it's on the margins, but let me run through a couple things. Under the orange phase, the state was saying leave home only if you need to. Now they're saying go ahead and leave your house. Just stay 6 feet away from people. Before they were saying wear a face covering in public. Now they're saying if you can't maintain a good distance, please wear a face covering. They're saying you can play team sports as long as it's like club league, not like a school event. Just do a symptom check before, where before that was not the case. And one thing is they were saying no groups more than 20. Now they're saying no groups more than 50 people. So it's starting to ease restrictions. And when it comes to businesses, certain businesses still had to close under orange. Starting Saturday in the areas that moved to yellow, every business can reopen.
And that's in those, again, in those areas that are moving to yellow from orange. Maybe let's talk about which areas of the state are not making that move.
Right. So there's Salt Lake City and West Valley City are staying in orange, but the rest of Salt Lake County is moving. And outside of that, you have Summit, Wasatch, and Grand that are staying in the orange category. Summit and Wasatch had really high spikes early, and it's since tapered off, but they're still concerned about it. While Grand is a tourist destination, it's where Arches is, they have few hospital beds, and they're just a little nervous about taking the step to yellow.
Okay. I want to talk about others who were nervous about making that step to yellow, but first, what's driving this move, Matt Canham? Is Utah's, you know, is it data around Utah's rate of cases that is allowing this to happen? How did the governor make this decision?
The governor said he did a careful review of the data. And what they're really talking about is the daily caseloads, what the transmission rate is, and that means that if you have the disease, how frequently do you give it to someone else? And the number of hospitalizations and the number of deaths. In the last little bit, the state has plateaued, which means that well, we still have a significant number of cases each day. Sometimes around 140 is the average in the last 7 days. It's not going up. So it's just plateauing here. Our hospitalizations have also relatively plateaued. We've had about 100 people actively being hospitalized at any day in the last 2 weeks, somewhere between 90 and 100. Our deaths have crept up. We're now at 75, and we've had some rough weeks. What health officials like Dr. Angela Dunn, the state epidemiologist, says is that death is a lagging indicator. People can have this disease for a while before they pass away. And so while we have deaths this week, it doesn't mean it's because of what we're seeing on the ground this week. But it is something they're keeping an eye on.
You talked about that plateauing of the case numbers and hospitalizations. I mean, that's still, you know, you reach a plateau. A plateau is kind of an elevated thing. What does the governor say about what happens if lifting these restrictions, you know, leads to a higher number of cases? If Utah starts to see a spike, do we adjust? What happens then?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're entering a phase where, from what the governor said, is they'll keep an eye on these stats. And he did say it's possible that we would revert. So let's say you're part of Salt Lake County or, say, Davis or Utah County, and you're in a yellow spot, and you have a significant outbreak that's starting to spread throughout the community. The governor would be then ratchet up certain areas to orange or even red if necessary, where there would be more and more restrictions.
Okay.
Obviously, the state does not want to have that happen. And so we have strike teams that the health department has put together to try to quickly respond to outbreaks at businesses or in neighborhoods to try to keep it contained. They think that strategy will work at this time, but the state has also said through the health officials that we should expect a second wave in this fall and winter. So we'll see what happens in the months to come.
In terms of this move from orange to yellow, not all of the state is making this move, as we said. But then there's also some areas of the state that wanted to remain in orange that were not allowed to. They didn't get a waiver to do that. Among them, Salt Lake County Mayor Jenny Wilson wanted all of her county to be in the orange zone, but only the two largest cities are making the move from orange to yellow. Tell us what happened there, Matt.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at what Mayor Jenny Wilson has said throughout this whole pandemic, is that while Salt Lake County has been the hardest hit, and Salt Lake City and West Valley City has taken the brunt of that, the virus doesn't stop at a municipal border or a county border. And so having different levels of restrictions, she thinks, could actually impact people who travel for work or to visit family, and then we can continue to have a problem. She wanted to hold off and see more data. The governor disagreed, and the governor has ultimate control of this. We saw the same thing with the city of Alta that wanted more restrictions because they're concerned about tourists coming to their town. Similarly, what we're seeing in Moab, and they were denied.
Okay, so requests from, and again, as you just said, the town of Alta, which is up Little Cottonwood Canyon, wanted to stay in that orange zone. So did the entirety of Salt Lake County, or at least according to Mayor Jenny Wilson, wanted that. Yeah. Both of those requests denied by the governor. I want to bring George Pyle in on this, the columnist, in just a second. But one more thing before we do that, the governor stressed the importance of still using masks, still maintaining the kinds of social distancing that, you know, had been in place, I guess, in a sort of more mandatory way. Can you talk about that, Matt?
Yes. I mean, the governor's been a big proponent of wearing face masks throughout this whole process. And his vantage point is, he wants Utahns to take personal responsibility for their health and how they can impact the health of others. And not necessarily have a government mandate, but to still keep your distance, still only socialize with people, you know, or at least where you can maintain good distance. Be smart in your social interactions. Wear a mask when you can't maintain a good number of feet away from someone else.
Also, just he said that people who are at high risk, meaning those who are, you know, older or who have underlying health conditions, they are supposed to treat this basically as though they are still in that red zone, right?
Yeah. High-risk people, and that's 65 and older, or people with certain health conditions, which would include diabetes, cardiovascular problems, obesity. People in those high-risk groups need to act and take much more serious precautions than what fits under the yellow category. So we're going to see how that plays out in the weeks and months to come when some of our residents in areas need to live under different restrictions than other people.
Hmm. Underlying health conditions, isn't that basically all of America, Matt Canham?
There's a lot of people who would fit under the obesity category in our state and in our country. So how that works and what other things, you know, you come into your own personal health, you might need to talk to a doctor about.
Okay. George Pyle, Tribune columnist and editorial page editor. You know, there are people out there who think that this is premature, that we didn't have enough time to go through it. In fact, a coronavirus researcher I follow on Twitter yesterday was saying this is too soon. I don't know. What do you think about what's happening here, George Pyle?
I worry that it's too soon. I think the governor is looking at data, the best data he has available to him. I think he's looking at the fact that the economy is going through a really rough time. He and the legislature seem reluctant to tap the state's almost $1 billion rainy day fund to prop up the economy at its hour of need. He is making distinctions between high populated areas and places where any kind of virus is more likely to spread. I think we need to hold him to his word that if things start to go bad, that he is ready to turn the dial back to orange or back to red. They've said since the introduction of this plan where they stress the fact that it is a dial, it is a dimmer,
right,
and not just an on-off switch, that there are more choices than on and off. There are degrees, and it depends on where you are, and it depends on the individual. I mean, he's a good Utah Republican conservative, and he believes in personal responsibility. So he's saying to us, okay, show me your personal responsibility. Show me you can stay apart even if businesses are open. Show me that you can wear face masks where it's appropriate. Show me that you can continue to do business remotely or do radio shows over the phone because it's common sense, not because I'm ordering you to.
Later in the show, I have an in-depth explainer on immunity and coronavirus with the Tribune's Andy Larson. And part of the conclusion of a number of health experts out there, George, is that, you know, this virus isn't going away anytime soon. So I guess, you know, these moves between risk levels are signals to people. And of course, you know, certain businesses and activities can now open up as a result of this move. How will the public respond to this? I mean, you can see the signals from the governor and that request to behave appropriately, but you know, how will and maybe how should the public respond to the signals they're getting from state government on this, George Pyle?
Well, I would hope that we would be careful. Part of the problem is you're going to have a few people, as we saw in Wisconsin the other day, who are going to fill up the bars and restaurants and just thumb their noses at the whole thing. But at the same time, I think you also have a very real risk that even if the government says, fine, everybody go play, a lot of individuals will make their own decision not to, that they don't feel right going out. They don't feel right going to restaurants and bars. They don't feel right going to the movies. They don't feel right sending their children to school when schools do reopen. And so the idea that the economy is just going to come roaring back merely because the government has removed its restrictions, I think doesn't allow enough for the fact that, you know, your business can be open all day long, but if there are no customers,
right,
who feel comfortable going out, the economy is still going to be in jeopardy.
Matt Kahn, I'm senior managing editor with Tribune. Is there, you know, anything we're leaving out of this story? I want to actually turn to another sort of part of this having to do with the moratorium on evictions, but in terms of the move from orange to yellow?
No, it's something that we'll see morph over time. Those areas that are now still in the orange category are going to be reassessed frequently. So we might see some changes even in the next week on those.
Okay. Just before we head to a break, Matt, and I know we need to let you go in a second, one thing that was also confirmed at yesterday's briefing on coronavirus was that the governor, as we said, you know, this is Governor Gary Herbert is going to let the eviction moratorium expire. This moratorium, what did it do, Matt?
So for people who are directly impacted by the coronavirus, whether they lost their job or they actually got the disease or were had to quarantine because they were near someone who did, it would allow them to not pay rent for, you know, the month of April and start of May here, and that they could not be evicted for that. Now, that expires today. So what it didn't do is it didn't say you never had to pay that April or May rent. but it said that you couldn't be evicted for it. You could defer those payments to another time, and they encourage the landlords to work out some sort of payment process for that. But there's advocates, a lot of them, who are very concerned that starting today and ramping up next week, lawyers would be filing a bunch of evictions, which could lead to people being homeless because of the economic uncertainty and hardships that we're seeing because of the pandemic.
Among those were several faith groups. Tribune reported Crossroads Urban Center, the League of Women Voters, right. Utah Health Policy Project, Voices for Utah Children. They were pressuring the governor to extend this to the middle of July. I assume the governor was receiving other pressure as well. And he says, I mean, for his part, the governor says, look, there's assistance available. People can get help with their, you know, there's federal aid money out there that people should be able to access. Can you talk about that, Matt?
Yes. He's thinking that there could be some relief programs through the federal government that could provide people with assistance. The state has also created a $4 million fund that would directly pay people's rents if they fall through the cracks of other programs. He's also, I'm assuming we're talking about unemployment, which for the until July includes a $600 each week bonus or enhancement from the federal government. He's hoping that those together will spin this off.
Okay.
These other groups, the ones you talked about, are worried that that won't be the case. And so it's something that the Tribune will keep a close eye on in the weeks to come.
All right, Matt Canham. George Pyle, the expiration of this moratorium, you know, the justification is there's help available. I think it can be hard for some people to actually get that help. Any comments?
Well, I think he pulled the trigger on this too soon. It's, as I say, these kinds of things ripple through the economy, and it isn't just a matter of whether the government has a lockdown order in place. It's a matter of whether customers are there and feel comfortable going to businesses and whether employees feel comfortable going to their jobs with a lot of public contact. What you worry about, especially in a Republican state, is that this is all just kind of a way to say, well, we've reopened the economy, therefore everybody should go to work, therefore we don't have unemployment insurance, we don't have extra unemployment insurance, we don't have moratoriums on foreclosures and evictions, as if just the fact that the government has not ordered you to stay home doesn't affect the economy. I mean, we had a piece today from Chris Stewart, you know, Congressman Chris Stewart, no socialist he, saying that at least if a worker is in a high risk group or has specific reason to believe that it's too risky for them to go out in the world, they ought to be entitled to extended unemployment benefits, just because their staying home benefits the whole of the community. And when somebody does something that benefits the whole of the community, it's not unreasonable to expect them to be paid for it.
George, I will direct people to that editorial, which is, I guess, at sltrib.com. We do need to head to a break. And in the meantime, we need to let Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham go. Matt, thanks very much for joining us for the first part of the show today.
Thank you.
This is Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined via the phone by Salt Lake Tribune reporter Bethany Rogers and editorial page editor George Pyle. It's our Friday morning news roundup, and we invite you to join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Bethany Rogers, we will turn now to the crystallizing picture of the business ties between TestUtah.com and the state of Utah. That there is a relationship is no secret, but TestUtah got a sort of exclusive deal with the state, a no-bid contract. We can dig into that in just a minute, but maybe to begin with, can you first tell us just what TestUtah is and how it came into existence?
Sure. So TestUtah is a public-private partnership and initiative between a group of tech companies and the state to sort of funnel people through this system of online assessment, a website where you can go and answer a bunch of survey questions and be screened and then potentially be directed to mobile testing sites across the state. And the way it came into being was really through a pitch from these tech companies. Initially, they approached the state with this idea of sort of providing, it was sort of a philanthropic vision where they were going to be providing testing and treatment to people for free, and they were interested in working with the state to make this vision a reality. Over time, it developed into multi-million dollar contracts between the state and these companies.
Okay. Who actually had oversight of this initiative? I mean, that was partially the subject of the reporting that you and Aaron Alberti did this week. And I think to get there, we have to talk about a TestUtah questionnaire and a specific question that appeared on it about these once touted malaria drugs to help treat COVID-19. The questionnaire was in some ways kind of where this whole process began, right? I mean, where the TestUtah project came from. Can you talk about that? You'll have to, I think, describe a few of the players as you do that.
Yeah. So we found in our reporting that this all sort of began with the these malaria drugs that you mentioned. We always knew that the malaria drugs were sort of in the mix because for a while there was a question on TestUtah that had to do with these malaria drugs and whether someone, you know, was a candidate to potentially take the malaria drugs in treatment for coronavirus. And so we kind of always knew it was something there, but what we found in this reporting is that the entire assessment and survey actually began as a part of an effort to distribute these malaria drugs. So we, through public records requests, got a whole bunch of emails between Utah pharmacists who had, who was basically stockpiling these drugs, and a doctor at the University of Utah, an occupational health physician, who's also the president or sits on the board of Safelane Health, which is the company that ended up writing the questionnaire used on Safe Utah. And the conversation basically was, let's establish a standing order at the state level that would allow people to get these drugs without a prescription from a physician. Essentially, they could just walk into a pharmacy and walk out with the drugs. And the way that they would do that was through one of these online questionnaires or tools. That questionnaire that they developed for the standing order, the standing order itself ultimately was scrapped. The state abandoned the idea of doing that. But the questionnaire kind of remained and lived on and was adapted into the questions used on for TestUtah.
excuse me. Some of the sort of pressure being put on the governor, on the government, not pressure, but I guess requests for that standing order, they were coming from the owner of this this pharmacy company that was stockpiling the medicines, Dan Richards, who has Meds in Motion, which is a relatively new pharmacy company that had, as you said, been buying up all of the ingredients for this malaria drug or the specific formulation of this malaria drug. How was that request received? I mean, you said it was eventually scrapped, but how did the state of Utah, when it had requests for a standing order, you know, kind of repeated requests, how did the state of Utah receive that request?
The email records we have are between Dan Richards, Dr. Hegman, and Dr. Joe Miner and Dr. Mark Babbitts with the health department. There are also a couple of other people who are sort of involved in the conversation among them. Mark Newman, who's tech CEO, CEO of NAMI Health, which is the contract holder for Test Utah. So they were emailing sort of back and forth about this standing order, and the state was really receptive to it. Dan Richards suggested a standing order kind of, March 12th, around there. And within about a week, the state had something drafted, and Dr. Babbitts circulated this draft standing order to Dr. Miner, to Dr. Hegman of SafeLane Health, and to Dan Richards, and basically asked for their help in tweaking the language and finessing it before before signing the standing order. So it was well received. Ultimately, the governor's office kind of stepped in. Apparently, the governor's office initially had just thought that this standing order would align the state with the federal government and provide these drugs for off-label use for the coronavirus. But they didn't really realize that it would be made available without a prescription. And once they kind of understood that piece, that people wouldn't even need a physician's involvement in the whole process, they sort of clamped down and just set aside the standing order.
They did eventually, though, contract with Meds in Motion to purchase these drugs. And then eventually, after that, asked for a refund and got it. Can you tell us about that part of the story, Bethany, just how that played out? And then I also want to talk about the question that appeared on that, the questionnaire that Test Utah had having to do with hydroxychloroquine. But first, just in terms of the orders that the states placed and then unplaced, I guess you could say.
So it's still not entirely clear who inside the government initiated the purchase, but there are email records showing that Kristen Cox, who's at the head of the governor's Office of Management and Budget, gave approval to buy 20,000 doses or $800,000 worth of the medication, and this was after the standing order idea had kind of fizzled out. So they moved forward. There was communication there between GOMB, or the Governor's Office of Management and Budget, and the Health Department, General Burton of the Health Department, about this initial purchase. The Health Department, meanwhile, was moving forward with potentially buying an $8 million purchase of $8 million order of the drugs. So, after the standing order kind of fizzled out, the conversations about the drugs didn't die down. In fact, the plan kind of morphed into one where the state would acquire a lot of the drug and then potentially distribute it across the state.
Yeah, but then in the end, this didn't all pan out. I mean, the money was returned, and that was, I guess, because of the fact that studies were being done showing that this medication actually didn't have much of an effect and could even be harmful to people who were trying to, who were taking it for treating coronavirus, right?
So subsequent research has suggested that there might not be any benefit. I don't think that all of the studies are finalized, or even a couple ongoing at the University of Utah and Intermountain on, the effectiveness of these drugs for different types of patients in different settings. So I don't think that the full, scientific research has been concluded. But yes, since then, there have been a number of studies indicating that it might actually present a risk.
Got it. There's some questions about who has oversight over Test Utah. I mean, Test Utah is, as you said, it has multi-million dollar contracts with the state of Utah, and it's doing testing, in a private way of individuals for coronavirus. But there are some questions about who has oversight, and that's because of this question that appeared on a questionnaire on their website. Can you talk about this part of the story, Bethany? Basically, a question about hydroxychloroquine and how it got there.
Yeah. So there was a question on a screening tool that basically asked about whether the person who was taking it had any allergies to chloroquine, hydroxychloroquine, whether they had certain, underlying conditions like heart rhythm problems that, you know, could put you at risk taking hydroxychloroquine. So it was a question that seemed very clearly geared to this malaria drug, hydroxychloroquine. And for a while, it was pretty unclear how that question even ended up on the survey. The people behind Test Utah kind of distanced themselves or downplayed their role in putting the question on there and basically said that all of the questions on the questionnaire were written in conjunction with the Utah Department of Health. Right. And our reporting kind of found something different. It suggested that, you know, the hydroxychloroquine question, far from being sort of plugged in at some point by the Department of Health, that it was really integral to the questionnaire from the very beginning when Dr. Hegman with SafeLane kind of presented the idea of the survey to the state.
Okay. And just to clarify a little bit, Bethany, the headline of the article that you wrote was from the start, a team of Utah business execs planned how to screen, test, and distribute malaria drug for COVID-19. Am I right that the plan that headline describes, that's basically what Test Utah emerged out of, was that plan?
Yes. Yeah, it was a standing order plan, which would have, created a survey to screen patients for whether or not they would be a candidate for hydroxychloroquine and then distribute that hydroxychloroquine to them through the standing order. And then that survey morphed into Test Utah.
Can I ask one quick question also about, we talked about no-bid contracts. Bidding was sort of suspended during the period of emergency that we've been living through this pandemic. Is that why there was no bidding for the contract on testing here for the state?
It certainly went through those emergency provisions, and those emergency provisions, were designed so that the state could move quickly to set up relationships, contracts, get supplies quickly. So they were able to sign those contracts, those multimillion-dollar contracts, and develop this plan pretty quickly because under the state's emergency order, emergency procurement rules, they weren't required to do competitive bidding.
Okay. George Pyle, I've been keeping you on a leash here for a little bit. We are just going to have to go to a break here pretty soon. But in terms of, the ongoing story of hydroxychloroquine, this malaria drug that was, that so far has not been shown to be useful. But, the science is still out, as Bethany said, and the hype that was around it. And then this relationship between the state and people who are flacking hydroxychloroquine. What do you want to say, George?
Well, just that I think there needs to be a lot of investigation of this. When there's a pandemic coming, when there's fear that a certain medicine that might be helpful might be in short supply, it can kind of be understandable in the heat of emotion that you would do some things that later don't look so good. But with the contracts, the no-bid contracts, not just here, but I think in Iowa and Nebraska, a testing rate that isn't when Test Utah does the tests, they get a lot fewer positives than when other people do the tests. They're balking at the suggestion that their testing regime may be examined by the Department of Health. A lot of these decisions were made not by the Department of Health, but by the budget people. This, whenever you have a crisis like this, there is a big opportunity for somebody to swoop in and make all kinds of promises and make a lot of money in a way that doesn't really help. And I think, State Auditor Dougal and the members of the legislature are talking about some pretty intensive postmortems on this, and especially understanding that we're probably going to have another pandemic someday, even if this particular one goes away, and we probably should be better prepared with pre-approved vendors and quick bidding procedures and things like this so that we're not caught flat-footed again.
All right. George Pyle, editorial page editor with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for those comments. Also, Bethany Rogers, who's been reporting the story. Bethany, there's a lot more to it, I know, and we will direct people to the Tribune's website to find the full story or in your physical paper. You are listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a minute with our underplayed stories of the week.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines from KCPW and Utah and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, and to save time for a segment with Andy Larson on immunity and coronavirus, we're going to turn right now to our final segment, the underplayed stories of the week. And Bethany Rogers, I will come to you and ask you to start us off with a pick for underplayed story.
So I would just want to mention Zach Podmore's story on the Seeds and Sheep program. It's right now, when people are interested in home food production, it's a program to distribute drought-resistant seeds to Native American families across the Four Corners area.
All right, check that out at sltrib.com. George Pyle, your pick for underplayed story of the week before we head to our final segment with Andy Larson.
Well, underplayed just because it's not about coronavirus, and it's no surprise. Apparently, Utah, once again, is dead last among the states in per-pupil spending for education. And I suppose with the economic problems we're having, it probably is only going to get worse.
All right, that's George Pyle's pick for underplayed story of the week. I'm going to go with a story by Lee Davidson that the mayor of Kaysville, Katie Witt, who is also running for Congress, is defying the state's COVID-19 restrictions, and she's going to allow a protest group to hold an outdoor concert by country music star Colin Ray in a city park. It's exactly not the kind of thing that public health officials want to see right now. That's my pick. You can check it out at sltrib.com. All right, Bethany Rogers and George Pyle with the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
We will turn now to my conversation with Tribune reporter Andy Larson about what we know and what we don't know about coronavirus immunity and about what our eventual exit strategy from this pandemic might look like. Andy Larson is a Salt Lake Tribune reporter who, in other times before our new circumstances, covered all things Utah Jazz. But for several weeks now, he has been covering in an in-depth way the pandemic and, in particular, the science of coronavirus and its spread. Andy Larson, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
Well, last time I had you on, we talked about vaccines, I think, and the timeline there. Earlier this week, though, you published a piece about coronavirus and immunity, and there have been some questions about whether and to what extent a person who gets COVID-19 and then recovers has immunity. Some of those questions were because of reports of reinfection, of people getting the virus twice. And then some of that had to do with a statement from the World Health Organization about immunity. Can you just remind us of that background, and then we can turn to what the latest research is telling us, Andy?
Yeah, so the World Health Organization a couple of weeks ago issued a statement saying that there is no evidence that people who have previously been infected and fought the coronavirus, COVID-19, have immunity in the future. And then, like you said, there were these cases in South Korea, about 350 of them, where people had tested positive, seemingly recovered, tested negative, and then tested positive sometime later. So for a while there, it seemed kind of sketchy of like, okay, you know, do people who have recovered from this thing have some level of immunity?
Right.
And if so, what is that?
And the answer, it turns out, is in fact, you know, that we can expect some degree of immunity for a certain period of time after recovering. And Andy Larson, you know, some degree of time, certain amount of immunity. It turns out this is not an on-off switch. You wrote that there's a lot of nuance to what immunity even is.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that we're making educated guesses about because we just don't know how this particular coronavirus works. So, you know, we can, for example, note that those 350 reinfection cases were pretty much debunked. It seemed to be a problem with the testing. And in fact, we haven't had a confirmed case of reinfection yet, which is a really good sign because there would be certainly a lot of opportunities for it, especially for like healthcare workers. Among coronaviruses that this one is similar to, it seems like the immunity lasts from anywhere between 40 weeks on the downside to a few years at least on the upside. You know, it kind of depends on the severity of the initial illness or the illness caused by that particular coronavirus, or at least it's correlated, I guess I should say. And, you know, we've seen these, we've got four monkeys, for example, that we've tested and reinfected with the disease, and they have this immune response that prevents them from getting sick again. So there are some good signs here, and again, allows us to have that educated guess that, yeah, we're going to have some immunity to this thing for a medium term after people get the disease.
Immunity is the result of something that you and I have discussed before because of a conversation we had about testing. Immunity comes from antibodies. Remind us what antibodies are, Andy.
Yeah, they're these blood proteins that basically circulate in your blood and look for any infections that you may have, whether that be bacterial, virus, or really anything else, you know, even like organ transplants, right, are fought against by the immune system. And these antibodies are particularly created by the specific infection that people have had before. So, you know, maybe the classic example is chickenpox, right? Once you get the chickenpox first, when you're young, then you don't get chickenpox later in your life until later, and then it actually becomes shingles when you're old, right? Like, so that's like the perfect example of immunity, is that it is, that there is some medium term length of immunity, but the immune system is really complicated, and in a lot of ways we still don't understand it, and so a lot of the research is being poured into it right now. But, you know, given that this is a novel coronavirus, there's just a lot we still don't know.
A sort of interesting detail from this research that you dug into is how long it can take to develop antibodies. Can you explain that?
Yeah, they do start to develop right away, but not in measurable amounts. Generally, you know, there was this study that was done in New York, studied thousands of coronavirus havers, and it basically from day 5 to day 49 were the extent of the antibody growth, if you will. And in general, they started to be recognized fairly early in that. Day 14, more of them started to be tested positive, and day 21. And so it takes a few weeks for us to really pick up on whether or not you have developed these antibodies.
Yeah, and that gets back to the accuracy of antibody tests, which I want to get to, but hold off on that for a second. There's one part of what you just described, that study in New York City, is that there are people in the general population who haven't been tested, you know, who are listening right now, who think that they may have had COVID-19 and recovered already, and so that they have some kind of immunity themselves. I think a lot of people believe that they've had it and recovered without, you know, getting an official confirmation that they had it. You've got some cold water from this research.
Yeah, I mean, so that New York study is a good example, right? Like, they tested a whole bunch of people, about 700 people who were suspected cases. And by their definition, suspected cases were people who were in the same household with someone who was a confirmed positive test and then got sick, or someone who was told by a doctor that they likely had COVID-19. And of those people, only 38% of them had the coronavirus, tested positive for those antibodies. So even among those people who are living with sick people or are told by a doctor that they likely have coronavirus, it still was unlikely that they had it. And that kind of goes back to, you know, we talked about the Sundance case, right? Whether or not this was something that was spreading in locally here, January and February, and certainly lots of people in Utah feel that they've had it. But it just is something that it's far more likely that you had something that was not the coronavirus and just had similar symptoms.
Right. You know, we talked about the duration of immunity. You said up to, you know, maybe 40 weeks. Is that what you said? For
40 weeks kind of is maybe worst case scenario, and then maybe a few years best case.
How about in terms of degrees of immunity? You know, how immune a person might be to coronavirus if they've developed these antibodies? Are they, you know, 100% immune from this particular coronavirus?
We just don't know. I mean, the truth is it does look like more severe cases do develop maybe more antibodies more quickly, but we don't know what happens with X number of antibodies compared to Y greater number of antibodies. You know, we just don't have the research there that tells us that, hey, more antibodies will definitely kick this out compared to a fewer number of antibodies.
When it comes to that, I know I'm digging into the details here and we're taking a lot of time, but I hope you're okay with it. The duration, you know, that 40 weeks or a few years, depending upon what is actually conferred, that's for this specific strain of this novel coronavirus, right? I guess the reason I'm asking that is because every year there's a new flu shot for a different strain of the flu. Maybe this doesn't matter given the timeframes we're talking about, but is the immunity that you develop specific to this specific, you know, strain of the coronavirus?
Yeah, good question. You know, it seems like probably that. So, you know, we're looking at a whole sector of coronaviruses, and the ones that, you know, the immunity seems to last for, or the antibodies seem to drop off for, after 40 weeks are kind of the weak coronaviruses, the one that gives you basically common cold symptoms, the ones that have been out in the community kind of this whole time, right? Like for years and years. And then the ones like SARS and MERS that were created these initial epidemics in China and elsewhere, those antibodies seem to last longer for whatever reason. So basically, we're just guessing on this novel coronaviruses, how long the antibodies will last based on what those similar ones are doing. But you're right, you know, the virus could mutate and that could affect how long those antibodies last. There seems to be some agreement that there should be some cross immunity there, if, especially within strains of this particular coronavirus. But we don't really understand that yet, you know, and there isn't any evidence that says, hey, if you've had this one common cold coronavirus, you're immune to this new one already. You know, we just don't know that because, again, this is a burgeoning field of research.
And then in terms of the, you know, there's this sort of problematic thing that we brought up briefly earlier, which is antibody tests, you know, they're not all that accurate. So it's hard to know who out there actually has immunity, you know, to the extent that they have it, other than, I guess, those who were confirmed through the diagnostic, you know, nasal swab tests or whatever, and then who recovered from that. It's really difficult to know who might be immune.
Yeah, and it's funny. These antibody tests, you know, report basically false positives anywhere between 1% of the time for the good ones and even 10 to 15% of the time for the bad ones. And what happens is when you have something that's rare in a population like the coronavirus is, that those false positives can overwhelm the true sample of people who are getting it. You know, so if you have a test that gives a false positive 10% of the time, but only 5% of your population has ever had the coronavirus, that means for any random person who takes that test, they're more likely to be a false positive than to have actually had the antibodies, you know?
Right.
So in that case, we have to be really careful about how we use these antibody tests. Be sure we're using really good ones rather than kind of the sketchy ones, and do some confirmation testing as well, some follow-up testing, whether that be from a different test or at a different time, to really confirm that these positives are true positives rather than false ones being given by these unreliable tests.
Wow. Just in terms of the end game for this, actually, Andy, I'm going to play you a clip of state epidemiologist Dr. Angela Dunn. On Wednesday, I asked her about the state's end game for this pandemic, and here's what she said. Is the sort of end game from the state's perspective just the development of a vaccine? Is that what stops the pandemic cold in its tracks at this point, or is there another option for halting the spread of coronavirus?
Yeah, I mean, so there are a couple options, right? They all are around building herd immunity. We're not going to be able to prevent disease effectively until 60 to 80% of the population is immune to COVID-19. And that happens one of two ways. Either people get infected or they get a vaccine. And we have such low prevalence here in Utah with COVID-19. I mean, my guess is we're less than 5%. We're doing studies now to more accurately predict that. But we are far away from having herd immunity due to everybody being infected. So we are looking towards that vaccine to be able to provide stability in our ability to respond to COVID-19.
Andy, I played that clip because it mirrors something that you wrote about, which is herd immunity and how we get there. To me, Dr. Dunn is saying basically, you know, the vaccine is our end game and possibly our only end game. And your reporting kind of comes to the same conclusion, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's been some recent research that says, hey, because you don't have full mixing in these communities, because you have some active, you have some people who stay at home, you really may not need 60 to 80%. You may need 40 to 50%, let's say, to really get herd immunity. And that still means Angela Dunn is right. And we're still very far away from getting that, right? And of course, that would mean untold more number of deaths and you know, an extended length of this pandemic, which I don't think we want. So yeah, I do think herd immunity as a strategy is so far away that, you know, it's maybe not the best approach. And in particular, I think we need to continue to put a lot of emphasis and maybe even more emphasis on supporting the scientific research and development that allows vaccines to occur, or the manufacture of the vaccines, right? To find a way to get out of this as soon as possible.
Vaccines, though, Andy, as you and I have discussed before, they can take years to create. They also don't always emerge. You know, a lot of effort and resources are now being thrown at this problem, you know, the central problem in the world right now. But we don't know what will happen. We don't even know if a vaccine will emerge, right?
Right. And you know, I think it's fair to say that it's likely that it happens at some point. But, and you know, there are some really good trials happening right now with the Oxford vaccine or the Moderna vaccine here in the United States. But the truth is that even both of those approaches are based on vaccine types that we haven't really done before in humans. And that means they'll have to be extensively tested. And that means that there are going to be challenges that we don't know about yet, right? And so I think that, you know, it looks positive. You know, this is a simpler virus than, say, HIV. So that's kind of the good news. But the truth is that, yeah, you know, 12 to 18 months, which is kind of what the timeline has been stated repeatedly by officials like Dr. Anthony Fauci and et cetera, it's an optimistic timeline. And so we have to be kind of willing to say, hey, there is this possibility that it doesn't work out, and that, you know, as worst case scenario as it is, that this is something that we just have to live with for a very long time.
And then how we live with it is an entirely different question, and you know, how we sort of remake society to be able to live with it. But that's probably a bridge to cross sometime soon.
Yeah, it's above our pay grade, right? But I mean, so many of these different changes that would have to happen in society if we're dealing with a 2 to 3 year long pandemic rather than something that can be solved relatively quickly.
Andy Larson is a Salt Lake Tribune reporter who, in the anti-COVIDian days, the pre-coronavirus era, was a Utah Jazz reporter, but who has since been writing clear and useful explainers on the scientific research around COVID-19. Andy Larson, great to speak with you, and many thanks again.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
And thanks once more to Andy Larson. You can find his reporting and everything else we've been discussing today at sltrib.com. That does it for Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis and to the team at Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Stay safe. Solidarity. Join us again next week.